I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Five former W.R. Grace & Company mine executives from Libby, Montana, go on trial today in an asbestos poisoning case that dates back nearly 70 years and the EPA calls the worst case of townwide industrial poisoning in history. At least 200 died and thousands are sick because of Libby's exposure to vermiculite laced with naturally occurring asbestos, which ribboned throughout the town and the walls, the sidewalks, the baseball fields. The government contends the Grace officials knew about the dangers as far back as the 70s and took part in a massive cover-up. We're going to speak to a reporter at the trial in a few minutes. But first, the story of Libby. It stretches back over 90 years when zonalite was found in the town of 2500. Zonalite was then the space-age name used to market vermiculite, the lifeblood of the community. But residents didn't know that lifeblood contained the most toxic form of asbestos and was killing them. A PBS documentary called Simply Libby, Montana tells their story. Libby resident Gayla Benefield is featured in the film. Let's start with her. We spoke to her in 2007 and asked how she was affected by the mine.
Both of my parents died of the disease. My father was the first workman's comp case. My mother was the first case of secondary exposure to actually die of the disease. My extended family of about 65 people, at least 30 are diagnosed with the disease. The disease has simply ravaged our family.
Well, there's a moment in the film where you speak of realizing that your father had come home from a quick doctor's appointment, and what was he told?
His lungs were completely wasted away, full of the dust he had inhaled for the 19 years he'd worked at the mine.
What was the view of the mine before people knew that it was poisoning them?
My father loved to work there, all of the men. It was more like a fraternity. My own father, when he was diagnosed finally with the disease, he was never told locally that he had the disease. We had to leave town to find a doctor to tell him what was the matter with him. He was heartbroken, and as were most of the men. Not so much that they were ill, but because they had brought this material home and had infected their own families.
By the way, are you affected by it at all?
Oh, yes, I'm diagnosed with the disease. My husband is diagnosed with the disease. He never worked at the mine. So many people have it who never worked at the mine. They simply lived, worked, or played in Libby, Montana.
Well, and tell us more about that, because at one point they were thinking of baking cookies with this stuff. Where was it other than insulation in the homes?
Actually, it was all over the town. People would take their pickups up to the loading facility in town and load them up and put it on their gardens as a mulch. The high school running tracks were built of this material. The schools were infected with it.
We want to hear a clip from the film where your neighbor, Les Scramstad, who in fact died, was saying how they just couldn't get over the dust when they first went to work, and the company handed out respirators that got clogged after 15 minutes, so, you know, he and others just took them off. And here's the response he got from his colleagues the first day on the job.
Tom DeShazer was sitting in there, and he was foreman of the construction department. And he said, "How do you like that dust?" And I said, "Jesus, it's the worst I ever seen. I can't imagine anything like it." And geez, they all laughed, you know, and slapped her leg and said, "It's just a nuisance dust. You'll get used to it." You couldn't get it off of me, really. It just stuck, you know. And so I took it home with me. And I'd walk in the house, you know, and my oldest daughter and my oldest son, they'd grab me by the legs, you know, because they was happy to see me and hear Governor Rita, you know, and she'd come over, you know, and we'd have a hug, and Christ, I was covered with this stuff, you know. It wasn't that I was being sloppy, it was just that I couldn't get it off.
In 1999, the Seattle Post-Examiner published an investigation into W.R. Grace's vermiculite mine in Libby. Grace and seven current and former executives were indicted on criminal charges in 2005. Now, some say it took so long because there was a presidential election in 2000. Republicans on the state and federal level didn't want a scandal. But, Gayla Benefield, you say the Libby business leaders didn't want the attention either.
Oh, definitely, definitely. They simply fought this every step of the way. They didn't want people coming into the community and seeing hazmat crews cleaning up properties and homes. And people really had their heads in the sand here, so to speak.
At one point, Governor Marks hadn't come yet to a town meeting. She does, and she's confronted by one of the citizens, Edward Purley. Let's listen as he confronts Governor Judy Marks.
They couldn't have done this without the sanction of the Montana government. This is a crime scene. Is the government going to do anything?
I truly am not a typical politician, but I want to be blatantly honest with you people. You are the ones that live here. You are the ones that have this diagnosis living inside of yourselves. I'm a family of six kids, a mother of two children. You think it doesn't hurt me when I see your kids have this? Yes. Can I fix it? No, but I'll sure pray for you.
When Governor March came to Libby, finally came to Libby, and she was shamed into coming to Libby, and then had the audacity to say, I will pray for you. This simply set the local people who are ill and whose family members had died on its ear.
Well, the government did eventually declare Libby a Superfund site, but not a health emergency. There was a question of whether or not to declare it a health emergency. What was the question there?
That goes all the way to Washington, D.C. There's over 35 million homes in the United States that are insulated with the material that came from our mine. We ship 80% of the world's vermiculite containing this applicable asbestos from Libby, Montana, over a period of, say, 80 years. If they declared a public health emergency, which was the only way they could go into a home and remove all of the insulation, the federal government would be responsible for cleaning up the other 35 million homes, because at this point, W.R. Grace had slipped conveniently into bankruptcy.
So was it ever declared a health emergency?
No. And it's just a Superfund site.
And how is your town now? Does it feel clean?
No, they're never going to get all of it in Libby. They recently found where they had relined creeks after a flood in 1995 with material from the mine site that we call riprap. It's large rocks. And this is where the children have been swimming, on these little creeks that run through Libby.
What happens now to you, to your town? Do you ever talk about moving? I mean, would anyone ever buy your homes?
Well, actually, it's really an odd frame of mind here, because the property here is selling like crazy. Out-of-staters are coming in. They feel that the EPA is here cleaning up the community. They're not afraid to move to Libby. But the biggest thing, people don't really understand it. There's a latency period with this disease. It'll take up to 50 years to manifest itself. So the children of the community, when they come into their 20s and their 30s, as some already have that played on the ball fields, they will start to feel the effects of the disease. We've got to find, I'm just hoping for medical research. My children and my grandchildren are all highly exposed. It isn't a feeling of doom in Libby. I think it's more of a feeling of hope. We have the CARD Center for Asbestos-Related Disease, that's actually now treating the disease, not just the symptoms.
But why didn't you leave?
Well, because I would have carried the fiber within my body anyway. You know, this has been my home for nearly 60 years, and so many people, I had seen so many people leave Libby that knew what had happened in here. Former bosses, supervisors, so many people in Libby, and they simply moved away and put it out of their mind. And how can you walk away from your own community if your people are dying?
Gayla Benefield, a resident of Libby, Montana. Gayla, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity, you might say, to spread the word.
That's Gayla Benefield, a resident of Libby, Montana. She's featured in the film of the same name. Many of her family members worked in the mine where vermiculite was tainted with asbestos. That mine was actually in Libby for decades before it was bought and operated by W.R. Grace. Well, Drew Guncar, the maker of the film Libby, Montana, joins us now. And Drew, as another person in your film says, these residents of Libby are either the saddest people in the world or they're making this up. Tell us the chronology of W.R. Grace's involvement with the mine. When did they get involved? When did they begin to get questioned about it? And what did people find they knew about the asbestos they were mining?
W.R. Grace bought the Zonalite mine in 1963, and they operated the mine until 1990, so under 30 years. In the 1950s is when the state mining inspectors came in and started writing reports. And in those safety reports, it was very clear that the dust at the mine site was toxic and that the company needed to do something to reduce the dustiness in the mine.
Well, in fact, we have some testimony. Much later in the 90s, there would be several civil cases, four in fact. And because of that, Earl Lovick, who was head of operations for W.R. Grace at the mine, had a deposition. Here's what he said in 1999 when he was asked about a report on asbestos toxicity that had been presented to him in 1956.
So as of 1956, the company knew there was asbestos in the dust, correct?
Yes, sir.
And the company also knew that asbestosis is from inhaling asbestos dust, correct?
Yes, sir.
And the company also knew there were workers at Zone Light who were inhaling asbestos dust, correct?
Yes, sir.
In 1956, did the company disclose to the employees that asbestos and the dust in the air was toxic?
Not that I recall, no, sir.
At least in the early days, they just withheld the information from the miners. If they were asked, you know, is this dust harmful? And this is a story that you heard again and again in Libby from miners. They would simply say that it's, you know, it's no more harmful to you than farm dust. I heard that several times.
Well, and workers tell you that later, officials told them, well, they just thought everybody knew. And the union leader, Bob Wilkins, who became sick with asbestosis, told you that in his opinion, W.R. Grace might have felt protected by the government because the W.R. Grace chairman, Peter Grace, was a good friend of the Reagan administration. First, we're going to hear from Bob. This is after Bob told you that in 1980, a government doctor contacted him about coming to see the mine. Bob gave permission, and then he received a letter from that doctor saying the investigation had abruptly been called off.
Now that might not mean much to you now, but in 1980 it meant a hell of a lot to us, because when I read that letter, Peter Grace had just been appointed by Ronald Reagan to head up the Grace Commission on downsizing the government. So he was interested in downsizing all forms of government, and the influence that they were going to use in Washington, D.C. was sitting at the right hand of Ronald Reagan.
Later in the film, W.R. Grace Chair Peter Grace presents the results of the Grace Commission to then-President Ronald Reagan.
I am pleased to present to you, Mr. President, with the private sector's survey's summary report. And with your weightlifting, that is not too heavy, but otherwise...
And so we knew that this project was dead in the woods.
Drew, what are you saying? Was there a cover-up here?
There is no direct evidence that the Grace Commission had anything to do with the government, you know, pulling any kind of investigation in Libby. We're simply showing that right when Ronald Reagan, you know, he formed this commission headed by Peter Grace, and at that time, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, who was planning to do a health study in Libby, pulled the plug. The events there were suspicious.
Our 2007 conversation with Drew Kincaire, his film is Libby, Montana. When we come back, the latest on the trial of mine executives that begins today. But first, a scene that didn't make it into his film, a Libby resident telling her kids why they can't sell their home.
How am I supposed to fix it now? I can't.
I can't take it out with your hands.
No, you can't do that.
Why?
Because it's bad for you.
If you have gloves?
Even if you have gloves, because you'd be breathing it.
If you wore a face mask?
Oh, yeah, you could wear a face mask, but then what are you supposed to do with it?
Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We've been hearing the story of Libby, Montana, where 200 people died and thousands got sick from asbestos-tainted vermiculite in the town's mine run by W.R. Grace and Company. Last year, Grace reached a tentative settlement of $3 billion with town residents. But today, a criminal case begins against five executives charged with obstruction of justice, conspiracy, and violations of the Clean Air Act. Kirk Johnson of the New York Times is in Missoula, Montana, covering the trial. And Kirk, you write that prosecutors say they have medical documents, emails, in which the defendants talk about the hazards of the mine. Give an example.
A medical study was done as far back as 1982, and one of the defendants wrote in response to it, the big problem here is asbestos caused cancer, and that's no surprise. So those kind of documents support what a lot of people in Libby clearly believe, that it's an open and shut case.
You also write about a Dr. Daniel Teitelbaum, a retired toxicologist who will be called as a prosecution witness. What story does he tell?
He had a toxicology lab back in the 70s and was given a contract by Grace to examine chest x-rays from two vermiculite plants. One was Libby and the other was in South Carolina. He examined the chest x-rays and wrote a letter back that said 30% of your miners in Libby have evidence of asbestosis and none of them do in South Carolina.
Two vermiculite mines, but it seems to show that the one in Libby did have asbestos.
That's what Dr. Teitelbaum found and what he is ready to testify about when he's called at the trial.
And what did he say Grace's response to his letter was?
He said he really got no response. He said they said thank you very much. He said he then called them personally on the phone and said, you ought to stop mining in Libby.
Well, what are the defendants, these five Grace executives? What is their defense?
The company certainly took steps to protect workers. In the 1970s, they put in a rule forbidding any smoking at the mine or on the property. Smoking severely compounds the risk of asbestos issues. They issued respirators, and on the issues of conspiracy and obstruction of justice, there's certainly a body of legal opinion that says they'll have a defense that we were just speaking for our own interests. We were defending ourselves through this process and not obstructing any investigation. There is a body of law and opinion, including Supreme Court decisions, that say that kind of speech is First Amendment protected. So there's going to be a fine line there as to what was public relations, I guess, or a good corporate defense by attorneys and so on, and what crossed the line into obstruction.
Well, in the meantime, you write that studies are underway in 22 states where the vermiculite from Libby was processed or packaged, and federal agencies are looking for people who graduated from Libby High School between 1950 and 2000. So obviously there is concern, you know, outside of this courtroom. But what's at stake in this trial? What are the Grace executives facing?
If they were convicted on all counts, these would be very lengthy jail terms and multiple $1 million in fines, and the company would face potentially hundreds of millions of dollars in fines.
Kirk Johnson, reporter for the New York Times, covering the trial of former W.R. Grace & Company mine executives. Kirk, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, here in Boston, a 12-year-old boy died suddenly of the flu last weekend, and now parents are scrambling to get flu vaccines and answers. The Centers for Disease Control say of the 36,000 flu-related deaths expected this season, children will probably account for about 100. Around 5 children have already died nationwide from the flu, and last year 4 children in Massachusetts died. So it's not unheard of, but still it feels impossible. Danielle Curator is a pediatrician here in Boston. Danielle, we know you didn't treat young Hunter Pope. His school, Boston Latin, was the first to be part of a pilot program that offered flu shots through a city program, and he didn't get one. We know an autopsy is going to determine what strain of flu he had, but we don't know if a flu shot would even have prevented his flu, correct?
It is hard to know. There are certain strains of flu which we cannot always get with the flu vaccine. However, because the flu vaccine can be very protective and usually is effective in the flu season, we do encourage all children now from 6 months to 18 years to receive their flu vaccine yearly.
This is new, isn't it? It used to be 6 months to 6 years.
Well, we've always recommended flu vaccine. However, this year there are new recommendations from the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, to vaccinate all children 6 months to 18 years because they do see that there is a need for vaccination in all of the pediatric population in order to prevent serious sequela from the influenza virus.
Well, we understand there are some families adamantly against any vaccinations for their children, but his family wasn't one of them, and the parents are now saying, you know, pay a little more attention because he apparently forgot, he lost his permission slip to get his flu shot, so they're offering that as a cautionary tale, you know,
sure,
to pay attention if your schools have these programs. But he was, by all accounts, well cared for, healthy. He went to school on Friday, last Friday, was sent home with a fever overnight, began throwing up. They rushed into the emergency room Saturday afternoon. He was dead by Sunday morning. Now, people are saying, why was this so fast? What's the cause of death?
Influenza itself can be very virulent, meaning quick onset and can have a rapid course where children get severely ill, many times with respiratory illness. And in children, when they have these episodes of sudden death, the most common reason is because of a respiratory illness, as opposed to adults where they may have a heart condition first and then have sudden death.
What should parents do when a child has a fever and is nauseous?
Well, there is a lot of illness going around right now, and so it's that winter season. If your child is having high spiking fevers, is feeling very lethargic, is having any signs of respiratory distress, those are all signs to contact your pediatrician or contact medical care.
And it seems as if, I mean, I can see a parent thinking, well, let me wait a day and see, but a day may be too long.
It is true, and I don't want to be an alarmist right. about it, because there are lots of colds and low-grade fevers, and children can get frequent illnesses during especially the winter season, so not to think that everything is the flu. But if you're seeing that your child is getting increasingly ill, and I think you know parents know when their child is not acting themselves, those are signs that you need to seek some help.
Dr. Danielle Curator, a pediatrician here in Boston, in the wake of the sudden death of a 12-year-old who succumbed to the flu. Doctor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, tomorrow in Here and Now, the woman they call the Rosa Parks of the North, the first black to move into Levittown, Pennsylvania. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the saga of Folsom Prison Blues after the news, Here and Now. Remember the bank bailout? It seems so long ago, but last week, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner's plan to rescue banks landed with a thud. He proposed buying bad assets with a mix of public and private money, capping executive pay at some bailed-out banks, and requiring banks to show how they use bailout money, and subjecting banks to a stress test to see how bad off they are. Well, the day before Geithner's plan came out, President Obama said that Sweden looks like a good model for a bank rescue. Sweden nationalized some banks when a real estate bubble burst there in the early 90s. So what lessons can the U.S. take from Sweden, which recovered well from its banking crisis, unlike Japan, which some say took too long to act effectively? Our next guest, Bo Lundgren, is the former Minister for Fiscal and Financial Affairs in Sweden. He engineered his country's recovery, making sure that banks had money, were lending it, and had the confidence of investors and depositors. He now runs Sweden's National Debt Office and joins us. Mr. Lundgren, welcome.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be at Spiritual, at least in Boston.
Thank you. And explain to us, how was your rescue package different from the one in the U.S.? And we all remember the weekend where then Secretary of Treasury Paulson gets down on his knees and begs party leaders to do a bank bailout. That was here in the U.S. What you did was quickly telegraph that you were going to, I think it's been said, extract a pound of flesh from these banks. I mean, there was a quid pro quo.
Yes, of course, but what we said, to restore the confidence, we introduced a blanket guarantee for all creditors and depositors. That gave immediate confidence, like Roosevelt did in 1933 when they closed all banks and then reopened the ones that were solvent after having authorities going through them. So we needed, first of all, to restore confidence. And then we had a package of support measures, but we told the banks that we would, of course, if we needed to go into the banks, be very tough on the banks. We change management if we had to take over banks. And we, for every amount we put into a bank, we would have the same influence.
This was very different from what the Bush administration did in the first bank bailout. They did not extract the ownership, as you said. To a critic's point of view, they just gave the money to the banks without any quid pro quo.
Yes, to be honest, I was a bit surprised, because I know and I understand, being a market liberal myself, that, of course, governments are not very good at running banks. On the other hand, if government has to go into a bank if there's a crisis, then governments shouldn't let easy money go into the bank system. Some banks we had to take over and liquidate. We did that, and when we did that, we changed boards and changed management, of course, in the banks, because we couldn't have a management who had led a bank that lost, like in this case with a bank called Gota, 37.3% of their total lending.
Well, we understand, too, that you required that banks write down their losses. In other words, be very transparent and clear about what their assets really were worth.
Yeah, we were. Very hard on this, because it was a necessity. One of the problems in the Japanese banking crisis, which is the opposite and took 15 years to really be handled, they were not transparent. You really didn't know what kind of losses there were in the banking sector. On the other hand, I mean, doing it was much easier in Sweden, since we didn't have these repackaged and once more repackaged securitized instruments. that the world has in this crisis. We had ordinary loan with ordinary collateral. It was easier to do the valuation.
Also, some say in addition to you're having that firewall between banks that just handle mortgages and investment firms that bought and sold mortgages, you have a much smaller economy. I mean, do you really think that what you did in Sweden translates to, you know, something the U.S. can do?
Yes, I think we learned from the savings and loans crisis in the 80s in the U.S., and we also studied what happened in 32, 33. And I think that there are some elements that you have to handle as a government. What's missing still in the U.S., and which I'm, as a Swede, is afraid of as well, is that the still lack of confidence is still there. And what Tim Geithner and the newly elected president has to do really is to implement a strategy which restores confidence, full confidence to the markets.
Well, what else do you think they can do that they haven't done? The second bank bailout, you know, does make some requirements of banks, but what do you think they need to do to go further?
In order to get confidence, people has to know that nobody's going to lose from another bankruptcy like Lehman's. Lehman's, of course, was a mistake, and that started the big loss of confidence all around the world. There has to be a clear commitment for at least the major banks that no depositors, no creditors are going to lose in that bank. That's a necessity, and if necessary, then government also has to take over a bank, like in reality, the British government has taken over Royal Bank of Scotland.
Well, some analysts here in the U.S., including Neil Ferguson at Harvard, say that there are banks in the U.S., that they're the so-called zombie banks. They are, you know, literally dead banks walking, and the U.S. is letting them go on too long. But in Sweden, you quickly stepped into those kinds of banks.
Yes, we did. I mean, we had this medium-sized bank, Gota, for example, which lost 37% of their total lending. Of course, it wasn't possible to restructure that bank. So we liquidated the bank and took the good parts of it and merged with Nordbank, which is today's Nordea, a very strong bank as well. But another thing that I could add, really, is that if the conditions you use when discussing with the banks are very hard, it's somewhat easier to get the owners to try to get private capital as well, because they understood that we were in hard business.
In other words, the threat of, as someone said, extracting a pound of flesh from the bank was enough to encourage them to turn around and get the private investment they needed to capitalize, to get the money they needed to become solvent.
Yes, but the condition was for every Swedish krona we put into the bank, we want the same influence. Then they wanted to, they tried to get other solutions, and a couple of them succeeded, which meant that we didn't have to socialize them,
right,
so to say.
Well, speaking of the word socialize, Mr. Lundgren, you're well aware that a lot of Americans, especially to the right of the spectrum, are not thrilled about the fact that President Obama points to Sweden as a possible model for how banks can recover here, because they say that's socialist. You know, we don't want our government getting in our business and taking over our banks. Sweden has national health care, and people pay 57% of their income tax for, you know, a socialized country. How do you respond to that?
Well, I know that there are things I would like to change in Sweden, but the Swedish economy is a market economy. Sweden isn't the country that socializes companies or banks without any reason. But what I mean is if you have a catastrophe, a financial tsunami, then you have to build walls, you have to do what's needed in order to save what can be saved. And then if you nationalize a bank because it's so bad off that there's no alternative, that's not really socialism.
That's crisis control, you say.
That's crisis control. Then you can start building the economy. And in a way, having first a stimulus package for the real economy instead of having a new package for the financial sector is the wrong way around. You need to have the financial system in order before you can have a recovery in the real economy.
Mr. Lundgren, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Bo Lundgren engineered Sweden's bank recovery in the early 90s when he was Minister for Fiscal and Financial Affairs. He's now Director General of Sweden's National Debt Office. You're listening to Here and Now. Question, how many hours a week do you spend in meetings? A recent study by Microsoft found that people spend nearly 6 hours a week in meetings, and more than 70% of them said they aren't productive meetings. Well, our next guest says that in general, meetings are so poorly run that they end up making people perform below their skill level outside of the meetings. Reed Hasty is a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He joins us from the school studios. And Professor, you say sometimes people hold meetings as a sort of a default. You know, maybe they haven't put a lot of thought into how to solve a problem, so call a meeting. But are you also saying, as some organizational experts are saying, that we shouldn't have any face-to-face meetings?
I mean, I don't want to go overboard on meetings are bad and everybody hates meetings. I really don't think an organization can get by on email and collaborative software and prediction markets. I think we really have to have face-to-face meetings. And I think a lot of what meetings do is they convey organizational culture. They let people stay in touch with each other. They give people a sense of where they are in an organization. So I'm pro-meeting, but I'm pro-
Good meeting.
Planned and systematic and organized meeting.
Well, so you made it clear you're in favor of meetings, but well-run meetings. What are the things that people are doing wrong that you see across the board that there are some of the most common problems with meetings?
Well, the person who calls a meeting, people who set meetings, need to be proactive. They need to be very clear in their own heads what the objective of the meeting is. And usually that involves some before-the-meeting preparation, homework assignments, if you will. And if the meeting's not productive, if people aren't prepared, just move on and reschedule.
Well, you also say that, you know, you can also keep an agreed-upon batting average. You know, there's sort of a group sense if there's somebody who's repeatedly running what everybody agrees is a bad or too long meeting, that's not their skill.
Right. Another ingredient in the recipe for bad meetings is people who aren't very effective socially running meetings. And it's a very harsh piece of advice, but I think a good organization has it in its organizational culture that there's an evaluation, maybe an explicit evaluation, like a batting average of whether the meeting was mm-hmm. effectively run. And when someone isn't very effective socially, I strongly recommend teaming them up with a co-chair person who can help do the social part of running the meeting.
Right. Well, how about making meetings shorter? You've heard of different ideas. Some of them are people suggesting have a taxi meter at the door. Everybody will type in their hourly pay, and then the meter will keep flicking on to show the meeting leader how much money is being spent, you know, of people's salaries holding everyone there. That doesn't seem very realistic. You know, what is?
Well, I have had people tell me that their practice is cold rooms and everybody has to stand up until the meeting's over to speed things up and move people out. The one piece of advice I can give that has to do with numbers is that meetings almost always have too many people in them. So one of the proactive things that you need to do when you're thinking of using a meeting, my first question to ask yourself is, do we need a meeting? The second one is, who should be there? And the third one is, I've overestimated how many fewer people need to be at this meeting.
Well, Professor Hasty, you explained that time spent in bad meetings is time spent not doing other things, which, you know, then can maybe rack up overtime to do those things. But what about when ideas in meetings don't translate into action? You say some companies keep very good track of what happens at meetings. You mentioned the California-based consulting company IDEO. What do they do?
They just have a system of recording everything. You know, they have sometimes literally scribes who are appointed to keep track of the stuff. I sometimes call that an evolutionary process, that for a system to generate good animals or good ideas and then select them and then retain them, it has to have some way of keeping track of them. And that's what our genetic code does evolutionarily. And, you know, we need to build it into meetings.
Reed Hasty is a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Professor Hasty, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, when we come back, a music critic is shocked to find out that before the Folsom Prison Blues, there was the Crescent City Blues, and they sound an awful lot alike. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back.
when I was just a baby. My mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
That, of course, is Folsom Prison Blues, one of the signature songs of the late country great Johnny Cash. Recorded by Cash in 1955, it was a top 10 hit, then made music history when he performed it for inmates at Folsom Prison in January of 1968. The concert album sold millions, and of course, the Folsom Prison performances were recreated in the film Walk the Line.
I gotta tell you, I can't tell you how many shows we've done, but this is the best audience we ever had. I want to thank you for that.
That's a lot of afterlife for a song that may have been almost entirely stolen. Boston journalist Daniel Gewirtz draws a direct line from the Johnny Cash song to the 1953 Crescent City Blues. And Daniel Gewirtz joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And Say It Ain't So. A lot of our listeners know of this story. Back in 2006, when the album Johnny Cash Roots and Branches was released, this was pointed out that there's a connection between these two songs, but what a connection. I mean, were you surprised at how much of Crescent City Blues Cash took for Folsom Blues?
I was totally amazed when I actually looked at the lyrics side by side, because I found out about this only a couple of months ago when PBS did the Johnny Cash at Folsom documentary. And they said that he did borrow, and there was a lawsuit at one point, but they didn't really go into how extensive it was.
Well, let's in fact just play a couple of stanzas of the song side by side. Of course, Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine, I don't know when.
And now Crescent City Blues.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around the bend, and I ain't been kissed, Lord, since I don't know when.
Crescent City Blues, written by composer-arranger Gordon Jenkins, not an unknown. Tell us more about him, and I guess that's his wife singing that on that 1953 recording?
Correct, his wife, Beverly Marr. The good part of this story is that Cash didn't steal the song from some itinerant, starving black blues man. Gordon Jenkins was not only well-known but well-paid in Hollywood as a top arranger. He did a lot of Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, wrote a few songs and put out a few albums. And one of those albums found its way to Germany when Johnny Cash was a 21-year-old soldier stationed there, and he loved the song. I guess he felt that the way to begin to write songs was to write versions of songs that existed, almost like song parody writers do today. So he didn't change many of the words. He didn't really change the emotional context, because in one song it's a lonely girl looking at a train going by and imagining the rich, glamorous people leading a life that she will never have.
I see the rich folks eating in that fancy dining car. They're probably having pheasant breast and eastern caviar.
And in his song, it's a guilty prisoner who hears the train whistle and imagines the good and glamorous life that those people on the train have and he will never have. So identical emotional content, but a different subject matter.
I bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know
Johnny Cash, in a 90s interview with a Canadian magazine, as he said, he heard the song when he was in Germany, and he said, at the time, I had no idea I'd be a professional recording artist. I wasn't trying to rip anybody off. It's almost like, the high schooler who cribs an essay and then years later finds himself a senator,
I don't believe that line, though.
Yeah.
Because 1955, just 2 years after he was stationed in Germany, he brings this song to Sam Phillips of Sun Records. He's already had a hit with Cry, 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 which he did write. So he was told, write more songs. And he brought this song to Sam. And I guess he told them, well, I borrowed it from an old obscure song.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if Sam Phillips really knew the truth about this. I suspect if he did, he'd get co-writing credit to Gordon Jenkins. It only makes sense.
Why not? Why not? Let's play the ends of the song back to back.
Far from Crescent City is where I'd like to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Far from those who risen, that's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Johnny Cash, again in this interview in the mid-90s with a Canadian magazine, said that he met up with Gordon Jenkins later and we talked about what happened and everything was right. Well, it wasn't quite that way. There was a lawsuit.
Yes, Gordon Jenkins apparently didn't know about the country and western hit. In those days, country songs didn't sell millions and millions of records. So he didn't really find out about the song or really get angry until it was a triple platinum album in 1968. And he quickly brought it up as a legal suit, didn't have to go to court. They gave him $75,000. He was satisfied, and the matter was dropped.
Well, and the song has another chapter. The artist Kemo recorded it for a Johnny Cash tribute album in 2002, and he had his own issues with the lyrics.
He had a choice of any one of a number of songs he could cover, so Kemo chose that song, and then he came upon the central lyric, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die," which is probably not only the most famous lyric, but the only lyric that Johnny Cash wrote whole cloth with no connection to the previous song. And he decided that that was too immoral a lyric to sing, especially as a born-again Christian.
So what'd he do?
What he did was change that lyric to, "They said I shot a man in Reno, but that was just a lie.
They said I shot a man down in Reno. That was just a lie. When I hear the whistle blowing, I just hang my head and cry."
Which changes the entire concept of the song, because it really is about a guilty man who knows what he's done and realizes he'll never get out of prison but is yearning anyway.
So what do we make of this, Daniel Gewirtz? You know, we revere Johnny Cash in many ways, but, you know, you're reminding us that maybe there's more than one Johnny Cash.
Well, I think one of the reasons Johnny Cash is such an archetypal figure is that he has multiple personalities. He's the man in black, but also a hero. He's an outlaw, but also a good Christian. He's a philandering husband in his first marriage and a very faithful lover in his second marriage. So I think that the combination of the light and the dark is just essential to making Johnny Cash an archetypal figure and a larger-than-life presence on the music scene.
Boston journalist Daniel Gewirtz, with thoughts on lyrics, Folsom Prison Blues and its forerunner, Crescent City Blues. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
You've got a way to keep me on your side. You give me cause for love that I can't hide. For you, I know I'd even try to turn the tide. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.